Let's get started. Thank you everyone so much for joining and coming together to learn tonight on this Monday evening. I guess we can say Chodesh Tov to everybody. So we're now really in crunch time as we get ready for Pesach, preparing on a, you know, on a physical level, also on a spiritual level. So it's nice to come together to learn a little bit of Torah. Tonight's shir should be continued to be a schus for Refuah Shlema for Shendel Devora Bas Chaya Chana, as well as Refuah Shlema for Shaul Ruvain Ben Gittel Sasha Shamir Ben Penina, and for Aaron Moshe Ben Leia Bela Besoch Shai Chol Yisrael. And of course, we continue to learn and daven as a schus for Refuah Shlema for the Cholim who've been affected by everything going on in Eretz Yisrael, and for the Chayalim that they should be safe and they should be successful, and the Chatufim that they should be safe and they should be returned, and we should hear Besuros Tovos and Yeshuos very, very, very soon from Eretz Yisrael. With that in mind, let's jump right in. I said this week we were going to start learning a little in Yonei Haggadah. Now, some stuff is going to be directly related to the Haggadah. Some stuff is going to be a little bit more zoomed out and just related to the general overall themes of Pesach. But of course, when you go through the Haggadah, you'll see how they can really connect to many, many things happening in the Haggadah. a few years ago, they put out a Haggadah from Rav Schwab. They put out a Hebrew Haggadah, Ma'ayan Beis HaShoeva. And they also put out, Art Scroll put out a English Haggadah, also from Rav Schwab. Beautiful, beautiful Divrei Torah in both of them. What I'm actually going to do is go through several ideas from Rav Schwab found on his Sefer Al HaTorah on the Chumash. Many of these ideas have been copied and put into the Haggadah as well. I haven't gone through so much of the Haggadahs that he have, either the English or the Hebrew ones, so I can't be quoting from them necessarily, but I would imagine many of these come up there as well, because they're such good slam dunk ideas. So let's go through a couple and we'll see how much we get through tonight. And Amir Tzashem, next week I think we'll also have one more shir before we get to Yontif. Fine. So the Torah tells us, excuse me, in Sefer Shemos, in Perek Yud Aleph, Daber Naba Oznei Ha'am, so please speak to the into the ears of the nation. But Yish'alu Ish Me'es Re'ehu, and they should ask of their friends. V'isha me'es re'usa, and each woman should ask of her friends. Klei kesef u'klei zahav. They should ask for the silver and the gold of the Egyptians. And Rashi explains that really Moshe Rabbeinu was being begged by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was pleading with Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, please, please ask the Jewish people to go ahead and ask the Egyptians for their gifts. Excuse me, I don't know what's going on right now. Rashi explains that the reason HaKadosh Baruch Hu was using the word na, the Gemara in Brachos says he was really pleading with Moshe, please, it's so critical that you go ahead and convince and really tell the Jewish people to ask the Egyptians, was that Avram shouldn't have a taina on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Meaning, Avram is going to say, listen, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I kept up my end of the bargain. What about you? You said my children were going to go into a galus and they were going to experience horrible enslavement and they were going to be afflicted. And they were going to be foreigners in a land. But you also said that they're going to come out with tremendous wealth. So, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, listen, make sure the Jewish people ask the Egyptians for their gold and their silver. So there are a few questions that many people ask this. Like, what was so important that he had to mamish beg? Meaning, okay, Rashi quotes this idea, Avram had a taina, but why was this the reason? Why was this the reason? Doesn't Hashem fulfill His promises because HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a promise? That seems to be a good reason. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is emes. Chos Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu emes. He's kulo emes. He's true. If He says something, it's true. So if He said the Jewish people are going to leave with tremendous wealth, why does Rashi need to say, well, Avram's going to be upset at you, Avram's going to have a taina? Why not just say, because you said so, HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Were you doing this just to kind of make sure Avram wouldn't have a complaint? That's question number one. I do want to point out, just because there's a nice, I think a beautiful vart from both Rav Cook and Rav Moshe Weinberger on this idea as well. So we'll pause from Rav Schwab and just point this out as well. Why was it so critical that the Jewish people actually left with wealth? Maybe we've said this in the past. I think I've spoken it out in a couple of Parsha Shiurim in the past. But why was it so important that the Jewish people left with wealth? You'd think you have a get-out-of-jail-free card. You're not going to stop in the break room to see if you can pick up a couple snacks, you know, that the guards left over. You're gonna run out of there. So why is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu demanded and he needed that the Jewish people go ahead and get the clay kesef and clay zahav? So two different ideas. Rav Cook explains that we had a slave mindset. We didn't have anything. We didn't own anything. But we were taken out. L'kachtem l'chem li la'am. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim. Goyim Yikarev Goy. We were going to become the Am HaNivchar. And that means we're going to be a great nation. So what do you need to become great? So you don't need money, per se. You don't need clay kesem and clay zahav. But you need she'ifos. You need goals. You need to have dreams. What am I going to possibly accomplish with my life? Why was it critical, explains Rav Kook, that the Jewish people got the rechush gadol, the tremendous wealth as they were coming out of Mitzrayim? Because we had nothing, so we couldn't dream of... We lacked a certain imagination, a koach hadimyon, because we didn't have possessions. Money is really potential. What are you going to do with it? My mother, I've probably said this story, I think, at least once or twice here. My father buys the New York Lotto, you know, Mega Millions lottery ticket. And my mother quotes to him the study that, you know, if you took the $2 that you spend on the lottery ticket and you vest it in an ETF or an index fund, and over X amount of years, you'll make X amount of money. It's so silly that you pay money for the lottery ticket every single week. And every single time my mother, you know, conveys this taina, my father says, I'm not playing to win, I'm playing to dream. What are you going to do when you win the lottery? Where in Eretz Yisrael are you going to move? What tzedakahs are you going to give to? What institutions are you going to support? What are you going to create now that you have this potential? What can you do that you couldn't do beforehand? We begin to dream of all these possibilities, explains Rav Kook, that the Jewish people needed to have Rechush Gadol on the way out of Mitzrayim if we were going to become a great nation. That's Rav Kook. Says Rav Moshe Weinberger, another thing that slaves don't have is any sort of achrayus or responsibility. To be a big nation, to be a great nation, means to take responsibility for others and to look out for other people. We know all about Moshe Rabbeinu. All the Sfarim talk about it. The Ramban talks about this. Moshe Rabbeinu growing up, the first act of godless that he did was looking out for another Jew. To be a great person, to be a big person, means to have a sense of achrayus and responsibility beyond ourselves. But a slave has zero achrayus. His meals are given to him. He doesn't even own his children. His master, the Adon, owns his children. He is nothing. So to be able to cultivate this midah, we'll call it, of achrayus, of taking responsibility. So says Rav Moshe Weinberger, the Jewish people needed to get the rechush gadol. So those are two ideas, again, beautiful back pocket divrei Torah. You can share them all Pesach long. But comes along Rav Schwab and he says the following. What's the definition of wealth? How do we define wealth? So he says many people will define wealth by how much money they have, irrespective, regardless of how they acquired or attained that wealth. Avram Avinu was completely different. Avram Avinu didn't consider assets attained or money attained from war wealth. That wasn't wealth. The Torah tells us that when Sodom, he didn't take anything from Sodom. He wouldn't even take a shoelace, the Pasuk says, because he didn't want to take anything, he didn't want to acquire anything that came through bloodshed. And similarly, the Torah tells us that he didn't keep any of the gifts from Avimelech for himself, because he didn't want that. They weren't given out of love. They weren't given out of like a real... It wasn't like a real matana, because I love you and care about you. I was trying to butter you up almost. He wouldn't have been satisfied. Again, Rashi's saying, oh, Kadosh Baruch Hu is afraid of Avraham Avinu's taina. What does that mean? So Rav Schwab explains that Avraham Avinu would not have been satisfied if the Jewish people had acquired wealth through battle, or if it was given to them reluctantly or begrudgingly. The only gift acceptable was one given in a wholehearted fashion. And this is why the Pasuk focuses, Dabir na ba'azneham, v'yishalu ish me'es re'ehu, v'yisha me'es re'usa. All of a sudden, they're friends with the Egyptians. So this points out Rav Schwab, this is highlighting that any gift that they were going to accept had to come from a sense of love and respect, and not just, I want to give it to you because I want you to get away from me. And that's why the next pasuk even points out, "Vayitein Hashem eschin ha'am beinei Mitzrayim." That doesn't mean that they listened and they gave them whatever they wanted. It could mean that also, but it's highlighting the way in which the things were given, the way in which the gifts were given. It was with chen, meaning they saw the beauty in every single Jew, and all of a sudden there was almost like a, you want to call it a love or a mutual respect. Hashem imbued that feeling in the Egyptians, so that the gifts would be given out of love, and therefore would hold up to Avraham Avinu's standards of gift giving. Now it happens to be we just benched Rosh Chodesh. Again, we just said it's a Rosh Chodesh Nisan right now. But we say in the Rosh Chodesh davening, when we bench Rosh Chodesh in the Hiratzon, so we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chaim Shel Osher V'Chavod. Which is interesting. What are we asking? You know, if you can, it's good. I'm not complaining. Ashiris is good when it's given to you, but is that what we should be asking for? It's kind of funny. What does Ashiris mean in that context? What does Kavod mean? It's funny. We're asking a Kadosh Baruch Hu for Kavod. That seems to be, it doesn't seem to fit. So Rav Schwab would quote his father, who would say, Osher means a life without any debts, and Kavod means a life with no embarrassment or public humiliation resulting from one's actions. And he explains that money can corrupt people very, very quickly, and we dive into a Kadosh Baruch Hu for the kind of wealth and honor that will enable us to live a life of upstanding Erlicha B'nei Torah. And I think this is really, again, what we're trying to say here. We wanted to make sure the money that we got, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Moshe to ask the Egyptians in a way that would, again, the Egyptians would find favor in eyes and give it to us in a loving way. So that's idea number one. Now, just because I looked at the Yehi Ratzon, I want to point out, I heard a beautiful idea probably a couple years ago from Rabbi Robinson, Rabbi Yaakov Robinson, who quoted the Rosh Yeshiva Ruchaim Dov Keller Zatzal. He said, if you pay attention to the Yehi Ratzon, so we actually repeat one thing twice. Anyone want to turn to the audience over here? I'm sure everyone's saying it, they're just not unmuting themselves. No, so wealth we ask for once, but we ask for Chaim Shiyesh Behem Yira Shemayim, and then a couple lines later, we say Chaim Shtei Banu Avas Torah V'Yira Shemayim. So, you could say one's referring to you and one's referring to children, but he noted that there's two, I would say, not just modes, but ways one can cultivate Yira Shemayim. There's an internal kind of, you work on yourself and you develop it, and then there's the family unit or the community in which one lives, which helps kind of like cultivate that or augment it maybe a little bit more. I thought that was just a nice machshav. Again, we're not going to go on that point, but something interesting to think about the next time you bench Rosh Chodesh. Fine. Let's move on. So the Torah tells us something interesting. Again, we have this pasuk here, V'hayo kisavo el ha'aretz asher yitein Hashem lechem kasher diber. When we get into Eretz Yisrael, Ushmartem es ha'avod ha'zos, and you're going to watch over, you're going to keep this mitzvah, referring to Karban Pesach. V'haya ki yomru aleichem b'neichem. And you'll say to your children, or your children will say to you, ma ha'avod ha'zos lechem. What's this avoda that you're doing? V'yamartem, you'll say back, zevach pesach hu la'ashem, asher pesach, abate b'nei Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu skipped over the homes of the Jewish people, Mitzrayim, v'nakvos Mitzrayim, v'esbatenu hitzil, HaKadosh Baruch Hu protected us, V'yikod ha'am v'yishtachavu, and the Jewish nation bowed down to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, the Jewish people, Rashi notes, bowed, this hishtachavaya, this bowing, was almost in hakaras atov for the imminent geula. We understood that we were at the footsteps of geula, and we recognized we were about to inherit Eretz Yisrael, and the promise that we would have children. It's a beautiful set of psukim here. The one thing that we're all very familiar with, I would imagine, from these psukim, though, is that lashon of maha avoda hazos lechem, of course, referring to the rasha. What is this avoda that you're doing? Now, if you think about it for a second, if the mechilta that Rashi quotes says we bow down because there was hakar satov and maybe even simcha for the imminent geula and inheriting Eretz Yisrael and having children, so why is one rejoicing when you know that you're going to be, you know, there's this ben that's a Rasha? It's kind of funny. You know that you're going to have a child that's a Rasha. Is this the, what exactly is going on here? What's the child really asking? And why is this the Rasha's question? So we have to understand that Rav Schwab points out that when the Jewish people were in the Midbar, so we only brought one Karban Pesach in the Nisan of the second year after leaving Mitzrayim. The Gemara in Yevamah says that due to the climate in the Midbar, so Bnei Yisrael didn't perform Bris Milah, you know, for the next 39 years or so that we spent in the Midbar. And since none of the men had a Bris Milah, that means the halacha is that an Arel, an uncircumcised male, cannot take part in Karban Pesach, and a person who has a son who is an Arel also cannot take part in the Karban Pesach. And because this was what was going on, So they really couldn't bring a Karban Pesach until, you know, they entered Eretz Yisrael. Now, what happened when they got to Eretz Yisrael? This is such a beautiful insight of Rav Schwab. We get to Eretz Yisrael, after all the time in the Midbar, and we hadn't brought a Karban Pesach in 39 years, almost 40 years. So we go through this mass bris milah, communal circumcision, just before Pesach. And then for the first time in a long, long time, you have all these kids witnessing a Karban Pesach for the very first time in their lives. So they say, what's going on here? Maha avodah hazos lechem. Now that's a pretty sincere question. It's a genuine question, and it makes sense for a kid to ask that. He hasn't seen it in 39, 40 years. Why would he know what's going on? So now, you could say it makes sense why the Jewish people are bowing down. We have children who are here. We're in Eretz Yisrael. We inherited the land of Israel. We have Geula now. We're bringing Karban Pesach, and we're able to pass on the Mesorah to an inquisitive child who's asking a question. We pass it on. They can know it, and then they're going to continue to pass it on. Points out Rav Schwab in a very sharp way that this question was only legitimate in the first year. Meaning it was only an honest question in the first year we were in Eretz Yisrael. Moving forward, says Rav Schwab, the kids all know. We had a massive Karban Pesach last year. Everyone got circumcised. Everyone brought a Karban Pesach. This was massive. What a huge deal it was. If a kid continues to ask, what are we doing? So it's evident, says Rav Schwab, that this person is disconnected and disenchanted and not interested at all. They don't really want an answer to their question. And at this point, so then the father's harsh lashon of leave it lo, you wouldn't be included because you're disconnecting and disassociating yourself from the tzibur. Rav Schwab, I think, has another beautiful diuk in the psukim that help, I would say, enhance this vart. Maha avodah hazos lechem is attributed to the Rasha. And the difference between all of the questions, you can say, is that the other son's questions are all prefaced with ki yish'alcha bincha, when your son will ask. There's no such thing as a bad question if it's genuine and it's honest, and that's what we want. And sometimes we don't have good answers. We'll talk about that in just a second. But we want all sorts of questions. If the Rosh's question was a legitimate question, meaning he was asking it from a place of sincerity, he was asking it in an honest way, so then it wouldn't be a bad question. But what do we preface his question with? Again, if you look at the psukim, it says, "Vahaya ki yomru aleichem." They will say to you. Meaning he's making a statement. He's not asking a question. He doesn't care about the response. It's evident, based on, again, how the Torah introduces his question, that it's not really a question. There's no question mark at the end. There's a period. What's going on? This is ridiculous. If it had a question mark instead of a period or an exclamation mark, then we would engage with it. That's okay. But you have to be honest about your questions. I'll share a story. It's kind of funny that there was a boy in school a few years ago. And I don't know how we got into this conversation, boys, but we were talking about tefillin in class. And a boy said to me, you know, Rebbe, why you put on tefillin? Give me one reason I should put on tefillin. Or give me one reason why you put on tefillin. So I don't know what kind of mood I was in. I don't know why I said this. But I say, why does it matter to you? Like, what do you care? And he said, what do you mean? I said, if I give you a reason, are you going to go put tefillin on right now? And the whole class was silent. Meaning, I knew the boy wasn't asking from a place of, you know, often we have boys who ask sincere questions and we engage with sincere questions. But I was explaining to him, I said, if you want to have a real conversation, I'm happy to have a real conversation. But if you're asking just l'shem asking and you don't really care about what's going on, you don't care about the response, so then we're not going to have this conversation. I don't want to engage in that conversation now. This was the, I'm not calling that boy Rasha Chas V'Shalom, but the way Rav Schwab is pointing out is that those questions are not questions that we're going to necessarily engage in. You know, like we can put on the back burner and we can, when you're ready to have a real discussion about it, we can come back and have a discussion. Just because we're talking about questions, I say this idea every single year, but I think it's so important. Especially with everything going on in the world right now, and many people have questions. And I think it's important to point out. The most frequent answer to any question, you know, when in doubt, someone asks a question at the Seder, why do we do X, Y, or Z? What's the standard answer you can give? And you're probably right. So the kids should ask. We do all sorts of bizarre things or unusual things at the Seder. to keep the kids engaged. And the halacha, we want the kids asking. But if you think about it, that's such a bad answer. I give the same mashal. Imagine you go to college and you're in one of these big stadium seating classes, 200 kids. The professor comes in the first day, everybody's there. You got into this class. It was a tough class to get into. Everyone says this professor is the best. Professor walks in the room. He takes off his jacket, puts his briefcase down. He stands up on the desk and he does the hokey pokey. He does the hokey pokey. Everyone's silent. No one knows what's going on. Everyone's like looking at each other. What, is this guy crazy? Is he out of his mind? But no one wants to ask, what the heck was that just all about? And there's one kid who timidly raises his or her hand in the front of the class. And he goes, yeah. And the kid goes, I feel bad asking, but professor, why'd you just do that? And he says, I'm so happy. I did it so someone would ask me why I did it. Right? It doesn't make sense. We do all these things, and the answer is, oh, so the kid should ask. Doesn't that leave us with more questions than answers? So I always thought that the reason we do this on the night of the Seder, when we give over the Masorah, we're talking about our national collective history, is to encourage ourselves and our children, our families, to ask questions and to teach them that it's okay to be okay with bad answers. Meaning, if a person has a question in life, a person has thoughts in the Ribono Shel Olam or whatever it may be. So we ask these questions, we seek out our teachers, our parents, our grandparents, our Rebbeim, whoever it may be. And sometimes you get an answer that's not satisfactory. That doesn't mean we drop everything because we didn't get a good answer. It means that we continue to go on and we live with questions. And it's okay to live with questions. Sometimes you get an answer to your question 15 years later or 20 years later. Or maybe you're only able to understand it or appreciate it in hindsight after you've gone through certain experiences in life. Or after we've learned more, we can look back and say, oh, I kind of get what was going on there. But I think it's so critical that on the night of the Seder, we learn and we cultivate this ability to ask questions and live with questions. And sometimes we'll get a good answer. Sometimes we won't get a good answer. But I think it's important to appreciate that. Now, once I mention questions, I want to jump to one vart. My father-in-law is a big fan of this idea. I think he quotes it, actually, he heard it from his brother. Uncle Aaron Prero, Rabbi Aaron Prero from Baltimore. But maybe he also saw it from Rav Schwab as well. My father-in-law was a big fan of Rav Schwab. The pasuk says, V'hoya ki yish'alcha bincha machar le'mor, ma zos v'yamarte ilov b'chozek yad hotzianu Hashem yimitzrayim yibes avadim. So the Baal HaGadah refers to this as the Tam, as the simple son. Parenthetically again, once I start talking about God, I'm reminded of all the different Devar Torah. My brother-in-law showed me a vart from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, such an awesome vart in Chinuch. The Torah is telling you that your children are going to ask you questions, and therefore it's incumbent upon an answer. It's incumbent upon a parent to think about answers for the question. Meaning, what is my son going to ask me? What is my daughter going to ask me? What are my kids going to ask me at the Shabbos table, the Yontif table? And to begin to think, how would I address these questions with my children? Again, it doesn't even have to be related to, Shabbos or Yontif. Talking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu or the Jewish people. My son asked me the other night, what was it? He said to me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can see everything, right? And I said, yeah, Hashem sees everything. He goes, but we can't see Him, right? I said, yeah. He goes, so is HaKadosh Baruch Hu kind of like a ghost? Like He could see us, but we can't see Him? It was a cute way that he conceptualized it, but and I was hoping my wife is home because she's much better at answering those kinds of questions than I am. But to think about, what are these questions? We talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu to our children, our grandchildren. So we should think, what is a question a child might have about this particular thing? Kish Alcha Bincha Machar Lemor says around Lichtenstein, the Torah is saying our kids are going to ask questions. So we have to think, prepare a little bit how we're going to answer questions. Okay, fine. Anyway, so it says, Mazos, what's this? Again, that's referring to the Tam. But if you look at Rashi Ala Torah, it says it's referring to the Tinok Tipesh, a foolish son. So Rav Schwab says, why is Mazos a foolish question? He just wants to know what's going on. So the Tells the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yosef Leib Bloch, explains based on the following pasuk and mashal. We say in Tehillim, and we say it in Kabbalah Shabbos, Ish Ba'ar Lo Yeda, that the foolish person, or the ignorant person doesn't know, Uksil, and the fool, lo yavin esos, and the fool doesn't understand this. So, he would give the following mashal. I appreciate, I was flying back from my friend's wedding early this morning, and a person in my row was watching the movie Top Gun. So there's like a, you know, the fighter, if you've seen Top Gun, I guess, right, with the fighter pilots and things like that. So what's the mashal? So Rav Schwab quotes the tells Rav Shiva saying, if a person walks into the cockpit of a plane, of a fighter jet, there are a million different buttons and different things that you have to turn on and turn off and everything, all the different levers. So he's looking around, he takes it all in, and he turns to the pilot and he points to one little button. He says, what does this do? What's this? Explains Rav Schwab, it's as if the person is saying, I get everything else in the cockpit except for this one thing. Uksil lo yavin es zos. This one thing. Everything else I get. Says Rav Schwab, it's a person who's like one question on a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Why does this one particular thing happen? As if we get everything else a Kadosh Baruch Hu does in the entire world, but this one thing you get? It makes sense to you that you put a seed in the ground and an apple tree grows? That makes sense to you? It makes sense that a woman can develop a baby in her stomach over the course of 9 months and give birth to it? That's good, right? That I totally understand. But this one thing? Why do, you know, X kind of things happen to Y kind of people? Hashem, I don't understand this. Says Rashab, that's expressing a little bit of foolishness. On the other hand, the Chacham, he's asking a question on a general way. Ma ha'idus v'achukim v'hamishpatim. He's saying, I want to understand everything. Yes, it's okay to focus, obviously, on one particular question at a time. But necessarily, says Rav Schwab, you have to have that background saying, I want to understand it all. I want it all to make sense to me. So that's the difference between like a foolish question versus the Chacham's question. Okay, so that's a little bit about questioning. Let's continue. Says Rav Schwab, this is another beautiful idea. I think about it every single year. Matzazo shanu ochlim al shumma. So the Haggadah tells us like this: Al shum shelu hispik b'tzikim shel avosinu lahach mitzad shenigla aleihem melech malchei hamelachim. So why do we have matzah? So the Baal Haggadah tells us that this is for the. It's to remember that the dough didn't rise in Mitzrayim until HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out from Egypt. Now, if you think about it, though, we know that the entire story happened. Right, Makos Bechoros and the Jews painting and everything like that with the blood and the doorposts. Kachatzos alayla, right, the famous Rashi there. The Jews had been waiting all night long for Geula, from midnight until morning. Now, I don't bake the challah in the house, but if you have 6, 7, 8 hours, that's enough time for the dough to rise. What's going on? That they didn't have enough time for the dough to rise? What's happening? So the Mechilta explains that when we left Mitzrayim, our dough didn't rise. Excuse me, it didn't have time to rise because of Giloy Shechina. Because the Kadosh Baruch Hu revealed himself. So what does that mean? That implies that it wasn't necessarily due to a lack of time, per se, but rather Bishas Geula and Bishas Giloy Shechina, the dough lost its ability to ferment, it lost its ability to rise. But the question is, what does one have to do with the other? You think of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you think of Gilui Shechina, maybe think about the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash or, you don't know, open miracles. You don't necessarily associate it with dough not rising. Right? Like, what's that doing here? What's going on? So says Rav Schwab, and in answering his question, we may also come to a new understanding of how matzah can both be, again, the symbol of Geula and also Halach Ma'anya, the bread of affliction, the poor man's bread. Rav Schwab explains that there are three ingredients to making bread. Flour, water, and time. Says Rav Schwab, since HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself is Lamala Min Azman, HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't constrained by time that we experience in this world. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed himself, so time, writ large across the board, was suspended. The Giloy Shechina necessarily meant that there was no time. Time was frozen because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, hey, I'm here and I'm revealing myself. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeemed the Jewish people, Mitzrayim, again, writ large, experienced this Giloy Shechina. We experienced the Giloy Shechina, and as a result of that Giloy Shechina, so the dough couldn't ferment and it wasn't able to rise. It didn't have the capacity to rise, but that was a direct result of Giloy Shechina. when we look at a piece of matzah, says Rav Schwab, so the piece of matzah that we're holding is really a manifestation of Giloy Shechina. Right? What an unbelievable way to frame a box of matzos or a piece of matzah. It's no longer just the poor man's bread, as we're going to explain. Right? We say, Halach ma'anya da'achalu abatsana ba'ar de Mitzrayim. A slave, he has no time of his own, so you have to make your bread quickly. The Jews in Egypt ate matzah because we didn't have time as slaves to allow it to rise. So on one hand, it's for sure going to represent the Halach ma'anya. But says Rav Schwab, with this new appreciation of why the bread didn't rise and become bread, but rather it remained as matzah, is because there was Giloy Shechina. And that Giloy Shechina was the reason, was the cause for the Geula and the Yetzias Mitzrayim. Mamela says Rav Schwab that matzah is now not just the bread of affliction, but it's also at the very same time, it is also the symbol of Geula and not just enslavement. So I think that's a beautiful part. There's obviously a lot to talk about in terms of time and zrizus for mitzvos, ushmartim esa matzos, and Rashi, darshins, not just matzos, altikr matzos, ela mitzvos. And we left bechipazon. We'll call it hastiness is a big theme in Yetzias Mitzrayim, but maybe we'll speak about that another week. What I want to highlight is something really special. And it relates to what we just said. The notion of matzah representing two opposites. I think it's the Abarbanel asked the following question. I think Rav Matzio Salomon Zecher Tzadik of Racha might point this out in his Agada as well. But the Manishtana is really one question. The child is pointing out we're doing so many things that indicate or express a certain sense of chiros and freedom, and yet we do so many things that express or at least commemorate a certain sense of shibud and enslavement. So what exactly is going on? The question is, the whole thing seems to be a giant stira, a giant contradiction. So let's take a step back for a second. Rav Schwab asks the following question. We don't say Halal Shalim on Pesach because the Egyptians drowned. We don't say Halal. The question on that is, what about Oz Yashir? We sing Oz Yashir, and not only do we sing Oz Yashir, but amazingly, the Mishnah Berurah says that a person is supposed to sing Oz Yashir right now with the same gishmak and the same simcha as if you're standing. Mishnah Berurah Mamash says, as if you're standing on the edge of the river, on the edge of the sea, and you would just watch the Mitzrim drown, you're supposed to sing it with such a level of simcha. So how could it be that we don't sing Hallel, Shalim on Pesach? And not only that, there's the well-known Gemara that the Malachim wanted to sing Shira. And a Kaddish Baruch Hu said, you know, Maisa Yodai, Tavim Bayam, my creations are drowning at the sea, and you want to sing Shira? How could it be? So I don't understand. The Malachim were told, you guys can't sing Shira, and yet we are supposed to say Oz Yashir every single day with such immense simcha. What's happening? So the Medrash tells us that Ein Malach Echad Osa Shtei Shlichos. A Malach can't do two things at the same time. A Malach is given one job, one directive, one Shlichos. It goes ahead, it performs that Shlichos. Once it fulfills or accomplishes that mission, so to speak, so then maybe it can get another mission or another Shlichos. Explains Rav Schwab that maybe we can suggest that a malach can't experience two conflicting emotions at the same time. It doesn't have that capacity to do that. At the same moment, says Rav Schwab, that the Egyptians were drowning, the Yeshua was taking place. And the malachim could not almost relate to the fact that the Mitzrayim were drowning, because they were rejoicing that the Jewish people were being taken out and they were being saved. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Malachim can't sing Shira. But the Jewish people, humans, not just have the capacity to live with mixed emotions and live with conflicting emotions at the same time, but perhaps that's what makes us most human. The fact that we are constantly juggling different emotions at the same time. And there's so many instances where this comes up in halacha writ large. We talk about, you know, Rosh Hashanah. And Rosh Hashanah is a yom tiv, and we're supposed to dress nice and have a suda. But again, there's no halal on Rosh Hashanah where there's a certain heaviness to the day because the, you know, Sifrei Chaim, Sifrei Mavis are open. So there's this balance of simcha and yira. And in general, the balance between Ava and Yira Shemayim, or Ava Hashem and Yira Shemayim. And we have this idea, this conflicting emotion of Avelus on Shabbos. That we say there's Ein Avelus Befarhesi, even during Shiva. In public, on Shabbos, we don't express, we don't convey a certain sense of mourning. In the home, we go back to a more, you know, prominent, I would say, expression of Avelis, but in public, we don't. One's in Shiva, okay, but it's still Shabbos. It doesn't mean that a person's no longer in Avelis, they're in the middle of Shiva. Elamai, there are other emotions that are supposed to be emphasized at different times, and our job as people in this world is learning which emotions are we supposed to emphasize at certain times, and which emotions are we supposed to, you know, temper a little bit at the same exact time. That's what makes us uniquely Jewish. And again, this Yisod is highlighted everywhere on Seder night. And that's really, again, the Abar Benel's question when a kid is saying, are we doing things for Cheiros? Are we doing things for Shibud? And we're saying, yes. The answer is yes, we're doing both. And it's okay because you can live with both at the same time. You can engage with both of those emotions at the same time. And it's not like we're supposed to chuck one and keep the other, but it's about learning to live with both of those feelings, both of those emotions at the same time. Rav Schwab tells I feel like telling the story helps bring the point home. But there was one Bein Azmanim when Rav Schwab was leaving yeshiva. He was taking a train back from the Mir, back to Frankfurt. And he didn't have enough money to get a train ticket. So he went to the Mashkiach, Rabbi Yerucham, and he asked for a loan. And when his Rebbe gave him the money, so Rav Schwab offered his Hakar Stov, and he said, thank you. So the Mashkiach turned to him and gave him Musri. He says, why do you thank me for a loan? So Rav Schwab was, what do you mean, why don't I say thank you? So the Mashkiach said, don't you know that there's something called Ribbis Devarim? Meaning, forbidden payment, right? There's Ribbis, you're not allowed to pay Ribbis, which is interest. And there's a form of Ribbis with words. Meaning, not just paying back by speaking a certain way. That can count or constitute a level of Ribbis. So the Mashiach said, listen, I know you come from Germany, you come from Frankfurt, and you guys are very proper, and you always say, Danke schön, you always say thank you. And then Mashiach gave him Musar. He said, apparently by you, courtesy overrules halacha, but a true Ben Torah has to conduct himself according to the values of Torah, and that would prohibit you from saying thank you. So okay, that left a pretty big impact on Rav Schwab. The following Bein Azmanim, though, amazingly, Rav Schwab once again approached the Mashkiach for a little bit of money to buy a train ticket back to Frankfurt. But this time he was very aware of you know, how to, not just the ask, but should he respond or should he not respond once given the money. So this time he took the money and just turned. And he was ready to go. And the Mashkiach said, what are you doing? And he started. He says, what do you mean? He says, where's your Hakaras HaTov? So he's all flustered. He says, Rebbe, I don't understand. Last year, you took me to task for saying Shkayach, and then this year, what am I supposed to do? So Rav Schwab says that the Mashkiach, Rav Yerucham, says something very profound. He said, yeah, you shouldn't say anything, because there's Ribbis Devarim. But your feelings of gratitude, your feelings of Hakaras HaTov should be so strong that it should overwhelm you, that you should have difficulty suppressing the words. And I saw that you didn't have any struggle, you just turned immediately. Meaning, we live with multiple emotions at the same time. Or conflicting goals, we'll call them. And it's not, again, says Rav Schwab, quoting the lesson that he learned from the Mashkiach, it's not about chucking one to keep the other, but it's learning to juggle both emotions at the same time. That's another one. Fine. Let's say, we'll end off with two more ideas. The Torah tells us again in Shmos Perak Yud Gimel, "V'higadat l'bincha b'yoma hu le'mor ba'avor zeh asa Hashem li b'tzisi mimitzrayim." Ba'avor zeh, what do the words ba'avor zeh imply? Ba'avor zeh, Kodesh Baruch Hu took me out of Mitzrayim, or b'tzisi mimitzrayim, Hashem took me out of Mitzrayim. So we learn that the mitzvah of v'higadat l'bincha can be fulfilled only when there's matzah and maror on the table in front of us. Rabbi Rimon Shlita has a beautiful idea where he talks about the different modes of learning. Some kids are, you know, audio learners. Some kids are visual learners. They're the experiential learners. It's a beautiful drasha that he has there. But points out Rav Schwab, the pasuk seems to imply that we were zochet to the geula because of the matzah and moror that we fulfilled while we were in Mitzrayim. V'yigadot b'nuch b'yom ahu limor b'avor zeh asa shem li b'tzeisi Mitzrayim. But it's funny because we just quoted it before, but the Haggadah says, Matzah zo shanu ochlim al shema, al shim shalo, he speak betzikim, shal avosin lahachmitz. Meaning what? Says Rav Schwab, were the mitzvos of matzah and morah the cause for redemption? Or were they the result of redemption? Two different ways to look at it. Rav Schwab says, what's going on? So Rav Schwab says, such a beautiful idea. He says, B'nai Yisrael were actually commanded to eat the Karban Pesach with matzah morah while they were in Mitzrayim on the night of, on the eve of Pesach. Why would they be commanded to eat these foods which symbolize, or which symbols are used to commemorate the Gula, even before they left Egypt? I don't understand what's happening here. They're supposed to commemorate Gula, we leave. And yet these things were consumed before we left. What's happening? So Rav Schwab says such a beautiful Torah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded the Jewish people to do mitzvos that are related to Gula, even before the Geula took place. Why? In order to test our emunah. These mitzvos are referred to as the chukos ha-pesach. A chuk is a mitzvah that doesn't have a reason that we can necessarily understand. When we were given these mitzvos, so we didn't really understand why we should do these things. We were still in galus. We didn't get taken out yet. We were waiting for the Geula to happen. We didn't know what was going to be. And yet the Jews in Egypt did what? They took care, they performed these mitzvos because the Kaddish Baruch Hu told them to. These mitzvos that we have represent our pristine, our pure amuna in a Kaddish Baruch Hu. The Torah is telling us, says Rav Schwab, that we were zochet to the geula precisely because we fulfilled the mitzvah because it was the Ratzon Hashem. Regardless of any reason, we weren't looking into any reasons, but Hashem said, do something, and we said, okay, we're going to do it. They didn't understand why they should do it. They were just told to do it, and they did it. So it was bizchus, that pashut amuna that we had, that we were zocha to the geula. That's what it means, ba'avorza, because of this. What's because of this? Not just the kiyam mitzvah, but the kiyam mitzvah done with amuna. Meaning, having no understanding, not knowing why, but this is the ratzon Hashem, and this is what we're going to do it. So there's a kiyam mitzvah, but the background, or the backdrop for that entire mitzvah, is amuna. Now, let's end with one more idea on Amunah, and then we'll pick up Mirtz Hashem next week. Did I type this up? I thought I did. Maybe not. There's an amazing, amazing idea. When the Jewish people get to Yamsuf in Parshas B'Shalach, so what happens? So, perhaps this is the greatest moment of national tefillah that the Jewish people ever experienced. We get to the Yom Suf and we have nowhere to go. We turn around, the Egyptians are coming, and we basically said we got nothing to do. V'yiru ma'od, the Torah tells us we were very afraid. V'yitzaku b'nei Yisrael al Hashem, and we cried out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Zok Rashi, a relatively well-known Rashi, I would say. Tafsu umnus avosam. What does it mean that we cried out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Rashi says that we adopted, we grabbed onto the craft or the weaponry of our forefathers. Meaning, we daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Tefillah was the weapon of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Asks Rav Schwab, was this tefillah simply, oh, we were following in their footsteps by davening? Or was something more significant and profound about the nature of their tefillah that related to the Avos? So Rav Schwab says that if you look at Slichos, we say, Anenu kisha anisi la Avram Avinu b'hara Moria. Answer us like you answered Avram Avinu on Hara Moria when Avram was taking Yitzchak to the Akedah. But if you look at the Torah, Parshas Vayera, nowhere in the Torah does it say that Avram Avinu actually davened to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the context of the Akedah. What is going on that Avram Avinu davened? What was his tefillah? What was happening? So Rav Schwab says something beautiful. He says that Avinu must have davened that his amunah shouldn't waver. That he should remain steadfast in his amunah. He was afraid that throughout the Akedah process he'd begin to doubt himself or doubt HaKadosh Baruch Hu, doubt what he should be doing right now, and then maybe not perform the Akedah. Avinu was davening that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give him, infuse within him, a certain unwavering sense of amunah so that he can fulfill what he was supposed to fulfill and do what he was supposed to do. We know that Yitzhak goes to daven, he's lasuach basad, he's davening for a shidduch. Eliezer went out to really do an impossible mission, to go to the land of Besuah and Lavan, find a girl from that family who would be Matim, who would be Shayach to Yitzhak. It seems to be totally bonkers to find one of the Imahos in that family. And yet, Yitzhak davened, says Rav Schwab, for the strength to not lose his faith, to not lose his emunah and bitachon, that such a miracle could occur, that he could find a wife, even from the family of Besuah and Lavan. And when Yaakov arrived in Charan, and he met up with Lavan, so he saw that this is going to be a tremendous nisayon. And he understood that he's going to need HaKadosh Baruch Hu's help to overcome this nisayon. And what did what did Yaakov say? Is it possible that could I pass by the place where my father's davened? And what were they davening for? To maintain their amunah, and I'm not going to daven there? So immediately he returned to Har Moriah, and he went to daven and ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that kind of koach. Meaning, what happened when the Jewish people got to Yamsuf, says Rav Schwab, so amazing. Tafsu umnas avosim doesn't just mean that we dive into HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but we dive into HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We were v'yiru me'od, we were very afraid. We trusted Hashem. We were on board. We were on the bandwagon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we were following Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron, and we were going to do whatever they wanted us to do. We were following HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But we got to this point where we looked at the Yamsuf and we saw the Egyptians, and for a moment, our Amunah wavered, and we weren't sure what was going to be. Says Rav Schwab, the tefillah of the Jews at that moment was a tefillah to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we want to continue to believe in you. Please help me believe in you. Please give me the koach and capacity to believe in you. That's something that I for sure have thought about over the past couple months, saying, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's going on. I feel like a little bit of a kseel, right? What's going on here? I don't understand anything HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. But give me the emunah to be able to live with that. Give me the emunah to continue to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to believe that, you know, called David Rachman Latavu Avid. To daven for emunah, I think, is something incredibly special. We think of emunah as a completely cerebral thing, and I have to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ways, and I have to understand what emunah is. But it could also be a certain emotional type of emunah that we have, as the Gra discusses. There's an emunah sichlis, but there's an emunah pshuta that people have in the lev. And to daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to say HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's all going to work out. Adds Rav Schwab, and we'll close, that we know that there are gemaras that say that there are a few things that are hard for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Gemara in the beginning of Masechta Sota, the Gemara towards the end of Pesachim talk about Kasha Zivugin. Making Shidduchim is as hard as it is for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to split the sea. And providing sustenance, Kasha Parnasaso Shal Adam, providing Parnasa for a person is as difficult as Kriyas Yamsuf is. Is anything hard for HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What exactly is happening here? So says Rav Schwab, that in the realm of Shidduchim, and in the realm of Parnasa, people can often question. One's emunah can be shaken a little bit. When it comes to the world of Parnasa, a person can work hard and be honest and erlich and do everything they're supposed to do. And they follow Shulchan Aruch and they trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he's going to provide. And yet, it could be challenging to make a living. And they can get to the point of, maybe I'm doubting what I should be doing, and maybe I should cut corners a little bit, and maybe if I do X, Y, or Z, or A, B, and C, I'll end up getting a little bit more. Such a person needs to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to have the koach of emunah, and to be able to ride out the difficulties. And the same thing is true in the world of dating. When a person is in Shidduchim, and maybe they're in it for longer than they expected to be involved in Shidduchim, and they're feeling a certain sense of pressure, or maybe they're sensing a certain sense of despondency, and they just feel like, I've been doing it for so long and nothing's been working out. In all of those areas, explains Rav Schwab, that's why it's kasha kekriyas Yamsuf. Because at Yamsuf, our emunah also wavered. V'yiru me'od. So says Rav Schwab, when our emunah begins to waver, the avoda is, and it's maybe a little bit counterintuitive, but it's actually to double down and daven more and say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please help me believe. Please help me continue to believe and have that emunah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're going to do everything right and you're going to help me. So we'll hold it here for tonight. Next week we'll pick up a little bit more on Inyanei Haggadah and Pesach.